Hey, welcome back to the Smart Couple podcast, people. This is the podcast for people that want to be smart and intelligent about their relationships and get out of blame, move past the victim seat, and use your relationship pain as an opportunity to become the warrior badass that you are and to get really the love and connection you want. And it's no light experience here in the Smart Couple podcast. There's some, a lot of edgy stuff we explore. There's terrain that's uncomfortable. And anyone that knows relationship and marriage after many years, you know that it's a roller coaster and it can flatten out and get stagnant and stale and all that. So if you're paying attention, you care and you genuinely want a different result, you look in the mirror. And that's what this podcast is all about. So I'm very excited to have this guest, Keith Witt, who is really incredible. I had no idea until we got into it here what a charged man this guy is. He's an elder. He's been around the block many years with his partner for 41 years. And man, this guy knows a ton about the human brain, the body, the nervous system, and what happens and what gets triggered in a long-term relationship and how to really continue to go to the next level in your long-term relationship. So Keith, he also weaves in the integral framework. If you're an integral person, it's subtle, but it's in here. And at times he gets going. And I had to, in my judgment here, bring him back down to like, hey, what are we trying to say here? So bear with us as we find our way. And man, is this guy smart and full of goodies. So check it out. I think you're going to dig it. And of course, as always, leave a comment in the show notes. Okay, everybody, welcome to the Smart Couple podcast. Today, I'm really stoked because I've got Dr. Keith Witt. He is a licensed psychologist, teacher, and author who has lived and worked in the Santa Barbara, California area for over 40 years. The dude has been married for 41 years. He's got a couple grown kids, and he is the founder of the School of Love. We'll include everywhere to find Keith here in the show notes, and I'm just stoked to have you here, Keith. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be with you, Jason.
Right on, man. So we have a lot of ground to cover. One of the things I really like about you, there's three things that stand out. One is this notion of responsibility in relationship. Two is like an integral framework for relationship. Mm-hmm. And three is monogamy. And I love that you're into those things. And I want to kind of just pick your brain and see if we can really mine the gold in there so that we can, the people listening who might be struggling in a marriage or relationship or can't imagine being married that long and being like alive in it, can benefit from our conversation here. So first thing I want to ask you, Keith, is how did you get into relationship work? Like what, give us a little bit of arc of how you got into that.
I grew up in the 60s, was born in Hawaii, raised in Los Angeles. And in my teens, when I was 14 and 15, I went crazy. And so my parents, found a therapist. We got into family therapy, and therapy was like a native tongue to me. It was as if you'd been raised in France until you were four and then went to the United States and didn't hear French. And then all of a sudden somebody spoke it and you understood it. Hmm. So in the process of going crazy, I got real crazy. So my parents committed me to a mental hospital where they gave me 23 electroconvulsive treatments.
No way. Wow.
Yeah, way. So that was a symbolic death and rebirth experience like many young men have in shamanic society. I kind of created my own in middle-class American society in 65. And as my brain cleared and also got fried, I decided I wanted to be a warrior and a healer. And in 1965, the only archetypes for warrior and healer I could find were martial artists and psychotherapists. And so I started studying martial arts and psychotherapy and never looked back. Around relationships, it became obvious to me early, when I was an undergraduate, that everything is relationships.
Yeah.
I was raised by, my father was a biologist, and I read a lot of science fiction, so I'm a scientist as well as other things. And it was obvious to me that from cosmic strings on up to the known universe and other universes, it's everything in relationship with everything all the time. And that at the level of self-awareness, we have relationship as art, just as humans take all the other instincts and turn them into art. And so all psychotherapy is about relationships, relationships with the different parts of yourself, relationships with nature, relationships with God, relationships with other people. And of course, the most demanding relationship and potentially the most beautiful and the most transcending relationship is a committed relationship with a lover.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's an area of I've specialized in for many decades now and written about and taught about and have a lot of opinions about.
Yeah, clearly. And you know it from the inside, having been married 41 years.
Well, we haven't been married. We've been together.
Together. Okay, cool. Together.
So just 11 years being together before we decided to get married. I mean, I was very suspicious of marriage growing up in the 60s because I didn't see any happy marriages from my standpoint.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
So I had to kind of reinvent the wheel when it came to the archetype of happy, fulfilling relationship, marriage, that made you stronger and more beautiful rather than weaker and more dissolute. And, you know, I discovered it, but, you know, was suspicious of the institution for many years.
Did you discover that as you met your now wife, or was that before?
It was kind of parallel. You know, I remember in 1981 telling my friends, you know, I've discovered that I'm monogamous. You know, so, you know, all the non-monogamy play that, you know, we've all been doing, I'm kind of not available. It's just not my nature. I've finally discovered, I mean, I tried hard in the late 60s and the 70s to not be a monogamous person. I really did, but I could just never pull it off, really. It never felt right. It never worked. It was just always a mess. And so, you know, I discovered it and decided, let's make it work. And Becky and I kind of went through that together. All the couples that we knew in the 70s have all broken up. We're the only one that's still together. So we kind of grew with each other through that into other developmental life stages.
Yeah. What would you say, I'm going to kind of weave all over here. What would you say are some of the glue that has kept you together? Whereas, like, why you two, why have you made it and so many other people haven't?
One, I think, is just genetic. I think I'm genetically programmed to be more monogamous. There's a gene called the vasopressin expression gene in mammals, and people have it, and it has 14 lengths. Maybe it's 17 anyway. The more lengths a guy has, the more likely he is to be monogamous. So I think I probably have all the lengths.
You like me, yeah.
Vasopressin expression gene. The other thing is that Becky and I were drawn to each other because both of us were interested in development, emotional, spiritual development. You know, that attracted me to her, you know, besides her being a very feminine and adorable person, and that attracted her to me. You know, we had a lot of passion that way. And so if there's a lot of developmental lines that you grow in. You know, you grow in your professional line and your intellectual, your emotional intelligence, and there's a psychosexual line, there's a relational line of development. And if you are if you have arrested development in any developmental line, it inhibits your development in all the others. This is one reason why people who develop an addiction at 18 or 19 don't develop much psychologically. You know, that addiction arrests their development.
Totally. And impacts the rest of their areas of their life.
Yeah, just and everybody is around them too. I mean, addiction's horrible that way. And so, you know, Becky and I wanted to grow together, and growing together is a tantric practice. And that tantric practice absorbed us. And we kept deciding, let's try to make it, when there's a problem, let's make it better. Yep. You know, when there's an opportunity to grow, let's grow together.
Key underscore here for me is the growth piece, that you both are aligned there, because we both know that if you have one partner into growth and the other person isn't, it's going to be pretty tough.
Yeah, because the person who's not into growth is dissociated. You know, it's a relatively new thing. To the millennial generation, it's kind of a given. We continue to develop throughout a lifespan. That's a radically new concept.
Yeah.
The concept of adult development just showed up around 30, 40 years ago. And most people didn't really, a lot of people when I was an undergraduate, even a graduate student, didn't much believe in it, which was ludicrous to me. because it's obvious to me people grew throughout the lifespan. And so if someone says, you know, I'm not interested in personal development, basically they're denying the voices in them that are crying out to grow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's the nature of self-awareness. It's fluid. It's a series of processes that we have to manage. And those processes are driven by genetic imperatives to evolve. If we deny them, we suffer. And, you know, that suffering takes the form. We see it culturally all the time. 1 in 10 Americans last year used an antidepressant.
Oh, yeah.
1 in 4 women in their 40s or 50s used an antidepressant. That's a cultural pathology. Why is that a cultural pathology? Because they're denying their inherent need to grow as individuals and to grow in a relationship.
And they're in a culture that supports their dissociation and medication away from their journey.
Yeah, it really drives me crazy. You know, you ask anybody who's an expert on depression, which, you know, most of us are in this business. So they'll say, well, you know, what's the thing you want to help people that cause depression? And what's the things that help people not be depressed? Well, the two things are, one, maintain yourself, you know, exercise, sleep, diet, that kind of stuff. And two, have great relationships. Those things actually predict less depression and less anxiety. And people that have high anxiety and high depression are compromised in those areas. Good relationships are better for depression than any of the antidepressants. Exercise, living a healthy life, is better for depression and anxiety than any of the antidepressants. And so psychiatric community gives up on the real deal and says, well, let's just medicate it out of the way, you know, and you know, it hardly ever works. So.
Yeah, totally. And a good relationship, would you say, is defined by two people who are willing to grow?
Yeah, and willing to grow means willing to encounter your own shadow as it emerges.
And most people aren't.
Well, none of us are happy to do it all the time.
You know, yeah, it's going to be intense, brutal.
There's different kinds of shadow. You know, you're a teacher, so you know there's one kind of shadow is just stuff we don't know. And so as teachers, we just want to put out a lot of information about how relationships work or sex works or love works, that kind of stuff. And, you know, you learn something that you didn't know. Great, that goes in easy. But there's also stuff that we resist knowing.
Yeah.
We resist knowing about our own violence or our own pettiness or selfishness or our own negative patterns or our own instincts to hurt rather than to help. And so there's a tension, there's a dialectic between that stuff wanting to come out and be resolved, to be integrated. That's the evolutionary impulse in us. And us reflexively resisting it. Now, us reflexively resisting it is part of being a human being. All human beings do this and have to because the defenses that develop when our brains are too immature to regulate them. You know, brains can't really regulate these kinds of sophisticated defenses until they're formal operational, until they're at least 14, 15, and 16. Well, by that time, these things have had 13 and 14 years to develop and amplify. And we've had more or less help from the cultures around us. And if we've had less help from the cultures around us, we've got a lot of programming for defensive states and relational defensive states that come up in terms of problems that we have to face. And we resist facing them because that's how our nervous systems learned how to deal with these energies.
So let me back up to your kind of the story of you going crazy, you said, because certainly you weren't very good at relationship back then if you were crazy.
No, I really wasn't.
Yeah. Okay. So in that process, somewhere in that kind of death, rebirth, or whatever you want to call it, you had you hit a pretty low point, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I was suicidal. I was miserable. I mean, you know, anytime that, you know, a 14-year-old is so crazy, his parents say, let's go look at sports cars and end up in front of a neuropsychiatric clinic and say, you know, son, you're going to spend the next couple of months here. You know, you're in pretty bad shape.
Yeah. So, and then were you medicated heavily? And I mean,
see, that was great.
The shock therapy.
They didn't have the medic. All they had was electroshock. And I'm glad, you know, I'd fucking rather have the electroshock than the medications because the electroshock actually worked. I wasn't depressed. And also, you know, there's some evidence, this is so weird, you know, in the last 40 years, that those kinds of traumas to brain stimulate neurogenesis. You know, and I've always been pretty strong cognitively. I think I got a boost from that. I don't know.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Now, you know, so I think I was well-loved as an infant.
Yeah, so you know, you had the conditions to somehow support moving through that trauma?
Well, you know, there's two characteristics of humans that are huge characteristics relationally. One is our attachment style, whether we're securely attached or not, you know, whether we can be secure with another person.
Yeah.
And another one is our capacity for social cognition. Like you and me talking now, there's an intersubjectivity going on where we're kind of sharing meaning making with each other. Both of us are socially engaged. We're feeling safe with each other. There's a lot of self-regulation that goes on. Neither one of these things is particularly influenced by genes, which means that all human beings are programmed to be securely attached if they get the right circumstances, and they're programmed to have enhanced social cognition if they have the right social circumstances to help them learn how to understand their own minds and other people's minds.
Yeah.
They're such powerful and adaptive characteristics that every human being on this planet, except for one family in England, are fully programmed to do this stuff. Okay. Now, what that means is that those are nascent forces that are pushing up through us. In my opinion, the reason that I went crazy is I wasn't able to affiliate in the ways that I needed to affiliate. I could not act out on my sexuality. You know, I have a robust sexuality that was completely repressed by 1965 middle class, you know, culture.
Sure.
I couldn't be intimate psychologically with people. There wasn't the language or the technology to be intimate, and I was desperate to do it. And, you know, literature, I like literature and poetry and music and stuff, but that doesn't do it. You know, that's not real intimacy.
Was there an event that popped you?
Excuse me?
Was there an event that cracked, like that had you go what you call crazy?
Yeah, adolescence.
Just that kind of gauntlet of adolescence?
Well, you know, one thing that, for me personally, adolescence, when your brain expands, it's a critical period, which means there's a lot of neurogenesis and apoptotic cell death, and there's new capacities for self-reflection that show up. Those new capacities for self-reflection, for me, you know, the person that I observed myself becoming really was unlike any other person in my culture. There was not anybody that had kind of felt appreciation for all forms of sexuality. You know, it was a very homophobic culture, for instance.
Yeah, there so you were super alone.
Yeah.
You felt super alone inside, yeah.
Yeah. And I was in, you know, I'm an extroverted, affiliative person. I was desperate for intimacy and was, you know, if you want to drive somebody crazy in prison, give them solitary confinement.
Totally.
So I essentially entered solitary confinement around 12 or 13, and then by 14 or 15, I was insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just... Forget wow. about it.
And then at what age did you come out the other side and something like, whether you call it healing or like, was there something that worked that had you, and talk about the relationships either with the doctors or your family or friends that had you come out the other side and intact and willing to pursue relationship and intimacy and connection?
Well, I don't know if I came out intact. Well, I came out with a commitment to be a warrior and a healer. And so I have a lot of resources. You know, I have a good genetic heritage. And so I took on the responsibilities of being a warrior and a healer. So I started studying psychology. I entered warrior pursuits. I practiced karate. I was a wrestler in high school and a tennis player and ran cross country.
Yeah. And you pursued all this on your own. No one was telling you to do this, right?
Oh, no, not at all.
So this is a key distinction for the listener that someone as motivated as you, it came from the inside. It was intrinsic, right? According to your values and what you cared about.
Yeah, and I think developmentally, this is important for us as parents. You know, parents, modern parents are more involved than parents have ever been, which is a good thing. And they're more psychologically minded, which is a good thing. One of the problems that the modern parents have is that you really need to understand your child's universe from their interior motivation systems, not from your motivation system.
Yeah, exactly. Not your agendas and top-down approach.
Yeah. So a kid might like soccer enough to play soccer, but he doesn't want to be I remember having a conversation with my son when he was 12. He's a tennis player, and he was really good. So you were driving down, and there was a coach in town who was a very competitive coach, was a little bit of an asshole. And there was another coach who was a really good guy, but his guys weren't winning tournaments. So I told Ethan, do you want to dedicate your life to being a tennis champion, or do you want to have tennis to be something that you get better at, but that is a part of a larger life? He said, I want to have it be something I get better at that's part of a larger life. I don't want to focus on being a super tennis champion. And so he went with the coach that was a more pro-social coach, and he was a good player, and his team won CIF, which was pretty good. But, you know, he didn't want to pursue it that maniacally.
Yeah.
So there's very few things that I've pursued a lot of arts in my life, but the art of being the art of psychotherapy and for many years martial arts, I did that maniacally.
Yeah. Well, what
so there's another level of commitment.
Totally. But what I'm hearing throughout the message here is there's a responsibility and a willingness to take responsibility for your life.
Absolutely.
So can you say more about that as it pertains to relationships? Because I know this is one of your a big talking point of yours is talk about relationship and responsibility.
So when we have, so there's different drives. These are attachment drives for us to bond with another person. One is lust. Lust is pretty impersonal. You know, you see somebody, you desire them and you want them, and it's healthy objectification at its most basic. But then when you begin to develop a relationship with someone, they take on a special luminance. That's romantic infatuation. And there's a whole series of dedicated circuits in your brain that get lit up.
Absolutely.
This is a temporary state that lasts for 6 to 18 months.
Yep.
During that state, you are primed to want to know about your lover and to identify your lover by all the best things in her or him. And you want to reveal yourself to this person, and you discover the best parts of yourself. This is a genetically programmed period where we can discover the best parts of ourselves and our partner. And we do. It fades after 6 to 18 months, sometimes a couple of years. And then when it fades, we enter a stage of intimate bonding where we begin to recapitulate levels of intimacy that we had in our family of origin, which on one hand makes us feel close to the other person, but it diminishes sexual urgency and it begins to set up more primitive family of origin patterns.
Like defensiveness and constriction and blaming and all that.
All that, you know, defensive states.
Yep.
So a sense of a form of entropy starts, and the relationship, and so the energy begins to dissipate. And so at that point, if the couple does not consciously decide to maintain their love for each other by maintaining themselves personally and maintaining their partner, they tend to drift into habituation with each other. They tend to drift into being so familiar that they don't do the things that they maintain.
Yep.
And, you know, other responsibilities come in, work, body, children, and so on. And often by the time a couple makes it into my office, they have lost, you know, that the dissipative process, that entropic process has gone on to the point where they've lost a sense of why are we together? Why are we partners?
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the sense of responsibility to maintain themselves and maintain their partner as they entered that intimate bonding state.
Yeah, and hold on. Why is that? Like, where do the wheels come off the tracks there in terms of responsibility? It's like not attending to the garden, right? They just one day just kind of like sit on the patio and watch the weeds grow. Like, obviously, that's not a conscious decision. That just happens. It's almost like it happens to people. Will you say more about that?
Well, first of all, it happens because it's evolutionarily mandated. Self-aware consciousness, as we experience it, probably the capacity for it only showed up about 200,000 years ago with a mutation on the FOXP2 gene. FOXP2 gene has 714 sites, and there were mutations on two of those sites 200,000 years ago that gave us the capacity for grammar, you know, I, me, you, and metaphor for symbolic communication. At that particular point, human beings develop an enormous number of capacities for superpowers, some of those being superpowers in relationship. The way that we're genetically programmed is to bond with another person, pair bond long enough basically to raise a child from 0 to 3. At that particular point, genetically, it makes sense to cheat on each other to have more genetic diversity. Yeah. Or, you know, if you're a guy, to accumulate women, you know, so that you have more genetic diversity. Or if you're a woman, to find high status guys and bond them to you emotionally or sexually or with children to protect you. You know, and so you see tribes being organized having to deal with these drives. So in modernity, in modern relationships, the way that these play out is an intimate bonding. We feel that diminishment, and we're more prone to be have distracting attractions. We're more prone to have affairs, that kind of stuff.
And then on top of that, yeah, again, we live in a culture that supports almost alienation from ourselves.
Yeah, dissociation.
Yeah.
It's dissociative culture. Now, not as much as it used to be, but it's still a dissociative culture, and especially a dissociation from radical acceptance. You know, there's a lot of popularity in mindfulness. I wrote a book called Integral Mindfulness.
Yeah.
Well, mindfulness, on its most basic level, is being aware with acceptance and caring intent of what you're sensing, feeling, thinking, wanting, judging. Now acceptance and caring intent means there's a lot of things that might come up that I want or I judge or I sense that are at odds with my value system. See, if I'm monogamous and I see an attractive woman and I want her, okay, I have to make sense of that. Now I can dissociate away. This is what my parents' generation did. No, I don't want anybody else. I just want my partner. Because we all knew that was bullshit. Uh-huh. I mean, anytime anybody said that, it was like that. Uh-huh. So if we want to be real, we don't dissociate. We go, so how do I integrate that desire and my capacity to fall in love with another person, even when I'm intimately bonded? How do I reconcile that with my desire for intimacy and for monogamous intimacy?
Yeah. Okay. So come back. Hold on. Because I want to come back to your stages. So we go through the romantic stage, right? Infatuation. We bust out of that. And we're now in this stage where you said we start to get
Habituated,
right?
Yeah, intimate bonding,
and then what next?
So let's say we take on the responsibility to maintain ourselves and our partner.
Yep.
Okay, let's
and we choose that. We choose to go to the next level.
We choose to go to the next level consciously. Now, some people do it unconsciously.
Sure.
You know, they just have relationships that are good relationships. Some people, a lot of us, have to do it consciously.
Okay.
So consciously doing it means recognizing what is it that this person needs from me to stay fulfilled, and how can I provide that from them, and what do I need from them to feel fulfilled, and how can I help them do that with me?
Yeah.
Okay, so that means smiling at each other. That means being kind to each other.
Respecting each other.
That means when I'm pissed off, to be able, you know, John Gottman calls it, you know, soft startup. That means, you know, when I'm pissed off, being able to be pissed off respectfully.
Yeah.
That means knowing what kinds of intimacy this person, my partner, needs to feel fulfilled with me and be invested in. That means in providing that. That means recognizing what kind of self-maintenance I need to do for myself to maintain my capacity
totally.
To love.
Yeah, so having my back so that I can have your back.
Exactly. So if I desert myself, say, physically, my capacity to love goes down as I lose cardiovascular, you know, as I get more confused. You know, there's all kinds of things like that.
Sure.
So if you take on those responsibilities, what happens is you now begin to go through life stages. Around, you know, you hit the late 20s, early 30s, you start wanting to have kids. And I didn't particularly want to have kids when I was 25. I was desperate to have kids when I was 33.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, that was just, I could just feel it.
Coming. Yeah, man. I was close. That mine was more 35-ish. And I was like, it's on. I just knew. I was like, come on, let's go, kids.
Yeah, I mean, I was dreaming about them, that kind of stuff. So you make the transition into parenthood. Now we have another challenge. 70% of couples in one series of studies were doing worse 3 years after the birth of the first child. Yeah. Half of a lot of divorces happen when a guy leaves the first year of the first child. Why is that? There's a huge – so – if we have responsibilities to maintain each other, we need to maintain each other even as we're falling in love with this child. Very hard for a mother.
Oh, yeah.
Because the same attachment circuits that have to do with falling in love are the circuits that get lit up with her and her baby quite often.
Yep.
Okay, so those are used up. She's in love with the baby. You know, this is where I think Freud got a lot of his Oedipal stuff. You know, like, you know, he observed this in, probably in himself, being a depressed guy, you know, in a poor family with a lot of kids. And so how does she maintain him, given that she's in love? How does he maintain his connection with her and kind of reconcile the new responsibilities and the new stresses that come from being a dad?
Yeah, because and also not getting his needs met, maybe emotionally or sexually, with her.
That's right.
How does he hang with himself?
So if those are objects of conscious awareness, you go, okay, pretty soon we start arranging to be more intimate. We start arranging to touch and affectionate and be sensual and erotic. We arrange to have our time together. You know, we work at co-parenting and helping each other with the inevitable stresses that come with nuclear families, because we're not programmed to have nuclear families. We're programmed to have tribes.
Yep.
So, you know, little kids are all to a certain extent, are reacting against not having tribes, and that reaction causes parents to try to provide a tribe out of one or two people, which stresses them out enormously.
Wow, good distinction there. Yep.
And so, you know, you notice the happier couples with little kids, they bond with other families with little kids. And if you ever gone camping, if you have little kids, you ever gone camping with three or four other families, everybody relaxes.
Yeah, because all the kids are like off playing and the parents are like, oh.
Oh, thank God. You know, we're in a tribal context and our genes are going, oh, yeah, this is where we're supposed to be.
Right.
It's like that. So you take on those responsibilities. And so 30% of couples are doing better 3 years after the birth of the first child. And nothing changes you more. Well, a lot, maybe there's a, maybe catastrophic illness. I don't know. But having a kid really changes you right away.
Oh, yeah.
You know. Okay, so.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you make that transition. But then that's just there's another transition. The other transition is into middle age. I mean, you know, we can all stay buff and beautiful until we're out, you know, our 50s, but at some point, you know, age takes over. Right. We're not buff and beautiful anymore.
Yeah.
I noticed that, and I don't know when I was. In my late 50s, I noticed that all of a sudden I was invisible to all the women, you know, under 35 in the world.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. That's just
a punch to the gut there.
That became the invisible man. I just disappeared. You know, so there's a transition in the middle age.
And
how do we mean?
And when that transition to middle age, is that kind of when kids are now leaving the house?
Or sometimes
it, not necessarily.
Well, because we're having kids later, it can happen when kids are younger. Because okay. We're having, you know, different combinations. It can be kids or teenagers often. You know, yeah. I've worked with a lot of people who are having a second family, somebody.
Yeah.
And so now there's another challenge for the couple to stay connected as lovers, to go deeper with each other, to become more intimate. Those deeper levels of intimacy, and this is about going back to monogamy, those are only available in relationships that have a certain level of trust and connection that you mostly only find in monogamous commitments.
Yeah.
There's a point, there's a level that, that in my experience, requires monogamy to go deeper. And that's the promise of monogamy. That's why it's worth it.
Yeah.
But to hang on to it and to not go to those deeper levels just leaves people pissed off.
And resentful.
Yeah, and so 25% in one study of women and 45% of guys cheat on their partner at some point. I have a manuscript that I've never published called 100 Reasons to Not Have a Secret Affair. You know, when I wrote that, I had to really work to keep it to just 100.
Uh-huh, wow.
And so you have to kind of embody the promise of monogamy to understand why it's a good idea.
So what? Give us a concrete example of at this stage. Like what did you and your partner do? And what do you find works?
Well, first of all, there's different things that work for different people.
Yeah.
One thing that Becky and I did is, you know, you need to recognize that there's a difference between the masculine and the feminine and between men and women. Okay, to men who are more visually erotic, sexuality is more a form of nourishment. It's like food.
Mm-hmm.
To women who are more contextual and relational, sexuality is something that's great when they feel like it and kind of doesn't exist when they don't feel like it. More mm-hmm. often. I'm painting in broad
generalizing, yeah.
Okay, so this is why Alison Armstrong, you know, the woman, one of my favorite women teachers of women, says women should have sex more than they feel like it. I thought that's a pretty brave stance for a woman teacher to take. And so one thing we did is we started Romantic Fridays. So Romantic Fridays, I only teach and write on Fridays. I don't do psychotherapy. So we'd get up and we'd hang out and we'd go take a hike. We'd go out to our favorite restaurant. We'd come home, we'd make love, we'd take a nap. We would do that every Friday.
Yeah.
So the part of me that had my masculine self that had the sexist nourishment, I had an anchor point each week.
Yeah.
You know, I knew, you know when you're hungry and you know you're going to have a meal tonight,
uh-huh.
Being hungry feels pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, when you're hungry and you don't know when you're going to eat again.
It could be stressful, yeah.
Very stressful. Yep. And so Becky had issues she had to deal with family of origin stuff, as did I. And both of us did the work. You know, we had therapy of various forms, both individually and collectively. And tried to pay attention to when the shit came out, when the defensive states came out. We tried to resolve them back to love. And tried to get better at it.
Yeah.
And so that happened with the emotional violence, because emotional violence arises with defensive states.
Yeah.
And so we got better and better at limiting the amount, being more caring when we were pissed. You know, kind of anticipating John Gottman's work, I guess. And at that point, I'd been doing I'd studied a lot of psychotherapy systems, and I taught them, and I generate them, and I'd written a few books. I mean, it wasn't that we didn't have a lot of information, and so it was like that. You know, three steps forward, two steps back, and before we knew it, it's 41 years later.
Yeah, I mean, it's refreshing to hear because, as you're kind of reminding us, there's no formula, right? That you just add water here and it just kind of works. It's you gotta roll up your sleeves and deal and find what works for you. And you guys found a way that works. And that was Romantic Fridays, and you both worked on yourself. You were both into growth. I'm imagining there's a number of other things you did, you know, just to continue to contribute to attending to the fire of your relationship.
Well, and also as a therapist, one thing about being, if you take the path of the warrior, which many men do, it's exemplified to me by Miyamoto Musashi's book that he wrote in 1645 called The Book of Five Rings. And one of the number one things in the way of the warrior is do not think dishonestly. In other words, don't be a hypocrite. So as a therapist, I couldn't work with couples and then encourage them, encourage the guys to not be a dick with their wives, and then go home and be a dick with Becky and not feel like a hypocrite.
Yeah.
So I had a lot of professional pressure on myself to kind of practice what I preach.
Yeah.
And so that was a good force, for me.
Yeah, that's helped me over the years, absolutely, is like being a hypocrite and just how awful that feels, and then going home and being really motivated to change. Like, thanks. Yeah. Because it feels so bad to be out. That, for me, that's just being out of integrity, right, with me, what I stand for.
Oh, and also seeing people that could love each other that aren't. I mean, I can't tell you how many evenings I've come up from my office and told my wife, I really appreciate you. You're really great.
Yeah.
I really love you.
I know, right? Feeling super grateful because some people are just in it, man, in it.
Yeah. And, I feel this, both Becky and I feel a sense of responsibility. She feels a responsibility to shine, to give me feminine light.
Yeah.
As a masculine person, I need that light. Yeah. I need that light to thrive. And she needs my presence. She needs my integrity. She needs that from me.
And that's you having each other's back there and giving each other what you need or want.
Yeah. And then that's complicated because we're human beings. Self-awareness created, we have 8 billion unique human beings that are driven by common genetic forces, and there's common archetypal forces also, but all of us are unique expression. And self-awareness is very powerful. You really can't change as a self-aware being unless you decide to. If you don't take on the responsibility, if you hold on to a block to development, you can block development until you die.
Sure.
I discovered as a therapist, I thought for the first 15 years I studied therapy, there must be some form of therapy that is so potent that I can do it and people will get better whether they want to or not.
Right.
My doctoral research was on that.
Wow.
And what I discovered is pretty much all forms of psychotherapy work if the person is authentically embodying their form of psychotherapy, and people get better if they decide to get better.
That's right. That's a hard lesson for therapists to learn.
Yeah. And right? Go on.
Well, I was just going to say my ego at the time when I was trying to help people was, no, I can help them.
Yeah.
I can even help this guy who's like totally jammed up, his hands tied behind his back, hating on himself, hating everybody and completely choosing it. And I'm like, no, I can even help him. And after so many frustrating sessions and years, I was like, it just got it. I was like, okay, I can help people who want help.
They have to make an opening.
Yeah.
There's our defenses create these barriers, these screens. And there's an evolutionary reason for this. The past 2 million years, humans have not been developing, evolving to protect themselves from animals or from tornadoes. Humans have been evolving to protect themselves from other humans because other humans are the biggest threat. Yeah.
Right.
What that means is that if we feel threatened by another person, there's a series of dedicated circuits to kick in that block us off empathetically from that other person so that we can fight or flight and block us off from self-reflection because there's no time for self-reflection when our survival is being threatened.
That's right.
And so in modern relationships, when there's a sense of threat, the circuits for self-reflection and empathy get shut down. And if we keep them shut down, we can't self-reflect and we can't empathize. The most extreme example of that most people see is borderline personality disorder. And so consciousness on the inside of that defense has to make a little opening where we can receive clean love. If we can, that can deconstruct the defense. And you'll see this with couples. If couples maintain their anger at each other, the only relief they can get is by attacking each other.
Yeah.
They have to open up a little channel in that anger where they can receive care and offer care to their partner. Mm. If care and love and kindness is exchanged, if that circuit gets established, and this is what we do in psychotherapy, this is what Susan Johnson's emotionally focused therapy is completely about. Once that circuit is established, it's exactly what we want. And then we can maintain that circuit. It supplants and we go back to social engagement and then we can do some stuff. And ultimately in psychotherapy, we want to teach people to feel a sense of responsibility to do that.
This is great. I tend to think that little window that you're talking about, this little window, you sort of are closing your hands really small. Like, is that, it's like a little seed, right?
Yeah.
And it, I'm kind of like, how does that get born? Is that just the person's history and their constitution? Is that enough pain finally had them crack a little opening to be like, this isn't working for me? Like, what do you, when you're in your studies, like, what is that?
It's a necessary developmental achievement, essentially. It comes with self-awareness. You know, children aren't aware of themselves as separate from parents until they're around 10 or 11 months old, when several things happen. One thing that happens is the kid knows he has to go to mom to get soothed if he feels bad. Another thing is the kid can walk, they begin to run around. And a third thing is the kid can feel shame if they've experienced themselves being disapproved of. Child does something that they feel is wrong. The parent looks at them or says something disapproving. The child goes into parasympathetic collapse, blushes, looks down, freezes, and social learning takes place. This is a necessary process for parents to teach kids how to be pro-social. It happens in every culture. I tell groups of parents, I go, you have to learn how to appropriately shame your kids. And all the child care workers go crazy.
Totally, totally.
Just
I love
can't
this.
Stand it. Okay?
Yeah.
You have to do
shame
it.
Shame is so necessary.
Totally necessary. So that little circuit, you know, you disapprove, you know, and then they get it back. And if it's a secure kid, if you pick them up after you disapprove, in 10 seconds they're back to happy sympathetic arousal. But a little social learning is taking place. This goes on. Every 8 minutes you say no to a kid between 10 and 17 months during the practicing period of development. And good parents maintain an attunement and they keep doing this, but nobody's perfect.
Yeah.
So that parasympathetic collapse is experienced by the organism as dangerous. And it is. You go all the way down in parasympathetic collapse, you die.
Yeah.
And so what human nervous systems do is create defenses for that parasympathetic collapse. What are they? They get mad at somebody. Because getting mad activates you sympathetically.
Yeah, the porcupine quills come
else.
Out.
Yeah. They blame somebody else. I don't have to be ashamed of myself because it's your fault, not mine.
Totally.
They go kick the dog. You know, they have accelerated expectations. Around 2 years old, when a kid develops a theory of mind, they can self-observe, and they observe themselves following rules or not following rules, and then go into shame reactions when they don't. Then those shame reactions are defended against neurologically with the defenses that I just described. Now, the more robust the dissociation circuits that happen when a kid, and kids that aren't securely attached have a lot of dissociation circuits, the stronger the defensive programming is.
Totally.
So parents externally regulate kids' defenses because kids don't have mature enough brains to do it themselves until around 12 or 13 or 14 when they can self-observe and you can begin to help them auto-regulate that stuff. This is a necessary developmental achievement, the capacity, and I call it the integrating the line of defenses, defenses line of development, in that we develop the defenses and then we learn how to integrate them throughout the rest of our life.
Yeah.
And those so that's why this stuff comes up. And since all communication is complementary, if I have a defense that comes up, you have mirror neuron systems in your brain that activate complementary defensive system, and now we have a relational defensive system. And in an intersubjective container of our relationship, now we're enacting a relational defensive pattern. If you and I are a couple and we do that over a period of several years, we get heavily myelinated circuits in our brain to do that under
that's
less
our, yeah, that's our habit.
It's our habit, and with stress, the way the stress works is if you can't resolve a stressor, it takes less and less of a stressor to have more and more of a reaction.
Yeah.
So it takes less and less of a dirty look to your wife to her have to be more and more pissed off. And so this is what happens if it's not regulated by self-awareness.
Yeah. And so, but to get, come back to my point, this little window, self-awareness though, it's like, where does that come from? Some people have a breakthrough in that moment and go, oh my God, I am the kind of cause of this nightmare. I'm going to do something about it and be responsible. Other people continue to close that little window and then they, you know, shut down for life.
At some point you have to decide to grow. Now, if you decide to grow, we all know what to do. First of all, you got to develop the neural territory and the tools of consciousness of self observation. So in integral mindfulness, I teach a basic mindfulness exercise in the first, 20 pages. And I go, look, practice this every day. If you don't want to practice this, practice some other mindfulness practice every day.
But you're already talking to people who are self-aware.
We're talking to someone who wants to grow.
Yeah. No, so again, you said we all at some point have to grow. I don't know if that's true. Like some people, I'm with you in that, wouldn't that be great? But some people just will not grow.
That's true. When they're not, there's still a force in them pushing them.
The evolutionary impulse, absolutely.
They have successfully suppressed, contained that. And those people, unless they decide, are lost.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're dissociated. They're unfulfilled. Their life lacks meaning and they're in pain, but they are stomaching it and somehow forging ahead.
Well, most of us are going to see this in our life is with somebody who's an addict. I can't tell you how many alcoholics have been in my office. And I go, okay, you drink a lot. And they go, yeah, yeah. And I go, so we talk about what alcoholism is. And I go, it looks like you're an alcoholic. So it looks like that if you continue to do what you're doing, you're going to be dead in 10 or 15 years. Your relationships are going to be rotten and everybody you love is going to be injured. And so either you decide to do something about it or you encounter all that horrible stuff.
Yeah.
And some people just walk out and continue to drink. And all that stuff happens. And some people go, okay, well, I'm willing to do something different with my drinking.
Yeah.
It almost doesn't matter what it is at that point. As long as they keep doing something different.
And that's the little window.
Yeah.
Yep.
Bill O'Hanlon is a great teacher. He's written a lot of books. One book he wrote, the title was Do One Thing Different.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, one little shift can make a big difference in a couple.
Now, the thing about love, and this is why one of the many reasons that I like relationships, we're motivated. You're motivated to change not just for you, but for your partner.
Yeah.
She deserves a good guy. He deserves a good woman. She deserves a guy who takes care of himself. I love her. I don't want her to suffer. That kind of stuff. And children, too. My son deserves to have a father when he's 25 years old or 35 years old. I better take care of myself. I've gotten guys to take care of themselves saying, if you don't take better care of yourself, your son's not going to have a father when he's 15 or he's 25. And, that breaks his heart to think that his son's not going to have a father. Yeah. And so he's more motivated to go start doing the stuff. So in relationship, because we love each other, it makes it easier for us to turn inward and go, okay, so to serve the people that I care about, I need to kind of address some of the things in me and grow. And that's the beauty of us.
Oh, totally. Beautiful. I'm loving this because I'm getting an education here. When I want to get your thoughts on this sort of attachment style approach to monogamy, let's say, versus a highly differentiated stance to monogamy that's like, hey, I'm going to be over here and be me and you be over there and be you. Because there's you could say those are extremes. One is like the work of Stan Takin, where it's like, it's my job to regulate you. And another person's stance on the other side is like, no, it's my job to regulate me. I don't want to reparent you. I don't want to be your dad. That's not our deal here.
Starch.
Yeah, exactly. So tell me, where are you in this mix and how do you work with all that?
Well, first of all, as usual, now this, I'm an integral psychology guy. I've written books on integral psychology. I like to hang out with Ken Wilber. I like to teach about integral stuff. And, integral says everybody gets to be right, but nobody gets to be right all the time. To me, it's a completely false dichotomy. It's ludicrous to hear people go back and forth. When I hear David Starch wrote a good book, but he's an arrogant guy. Uh-huh. I'm uncomfortable with this attachment. There's too much focused on attachment. People need to differentiate. Well, of course they do, David.
Because it's a developmental stage.
Yeah, first of all, secure attachment is basically, we are born addicted to other people. Okay, it's an addiction. You know, attachment is an addiction, and we're going to have it for all our lives. It's the same circuits. If we don't have it, we go through withdrawal, and it drives us crazy. We can either be securely attached or not securely attached. Securely attached people affiliate when they want to affiliate, and then when they want to go do something on their own, do something on their own. A securely attached, this is what characterizes a securely attached infant. If you do a little test called the strange situation test, where you bring a mother and a kid, okay, bring a mother and a kid, mother leaves, mother comes back, and how the kid responds to the mother when she comes back is very revealing. A securely attached kid will get pissed off when mom leaves, will protest. Mom comes back and he goes, mommy, mommy, and he's secure. After a few seconds, he's back to having fun with all the toys in the room. In other words, he's good at connecting, secure, differentiate. This connecting, differentiating thing is the human rhythm, and what secure people do is naturally do that. In relationships where people are secure with each other, they naturally do that.
And the upset when there's separation is okay and it's welcome because it's like, that's normal. Hey, I'm sad that you're leaving, but yeah. Then when you come back, I'm psyched. It's okay.
It's necessary. This is another problem with American culture, which basically pathologizes all psychological pain.
Yeah.
Oh, you have psychological pain, get into therapy and take drugs. No.
Right.
You have psychological pain. That means you're a human being who's not fully dissociated. Learn how to integrate your psychological pain into a coherent self, and you're going to feel good most of the time, and sometimes you're going to feel bad. And you should feel bad when you lose someone you love or someone you love goes away. You're going to miss them, of course.
Yeah.
And so this is
so that's secure. Yeah, that's secure attachment.
So that's the false dichotomy. You know, when you're in relationships, so the insecure kids, of course, the ambivalent, anxious kids get all clingy, and they don't go off and play by themselves. The avoidant kids who have dismissive parents, they're not aware of their attachment needs. Their physiology is saying, I want to be attached, but they're not conscious of it. They're dissociated from it. And these kids are more likely to be criminals and rapists.
Yeah, they're out in the streets playing with no supervision. They're out, there's no adult nearby.
Well, yes. Though if they were securely attached as kids, they have, you know, those kids, if
they have awareness.
If they're securely attached as kids, if they're out in the street without adults, they're creating secure attachments with their friends or with teachers.
Yeah, nice.
Because remember, communication relationship is reciprocal. If I have a capacity for secure attachment, I'm going to elicit it in people that are able to do it around me.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, if I'm a dismissive person, I'm going to get dismissive stuff back. Or if I'm a clingy person, I'm going to get clingy stuff back.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's a false dichotomy. A truly differentiated person is someone that recognizes that there's complete autonomy on one end, there's confluence where I lose myself in another, you know, mutual orgasm, and that we go back and forth along that continuum as life dictates, and we do it in harmony with another person. That's a coherent life. And as the more that we do that, the more consistent we are with the deeper forces. Those deeper forces, in my opinion, are connected with collective fields that we all share that are interfaced with spirit. And so ultimately, we want to become clearer channels of spirit. And spirit wants me to love well. Spirit wants me to give well. Spirit wants me to live well.
Yeah. Okay. So to reflect back a couple things I got there, a coherent self, maybe even a coherent relationship, a connected relationship is one that allows for connection and separation, connection, separation, connection, separation.
It needs it.
Right? That's necessary.
But when you separate in a relationship, and this is good or bad. You know, my wife is not in this room, but she exists in me right now.
Yeah.
Now, in the wife that's in me now, the Becky that's in me now, exists in me, cares for Keith. She feels a sense of responsibility to love Keith. You know, Becky, if you asked her now, what about Keith? Yeah, you know, Keith cares for me. The Keith that she carries is a secure Keith. Keith's not cheating on me. You know, Keith's not engaging in behavior that would hurt us.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're always in relationship with people, whether they're in the room or not. If it's a secure relationship, that person that you carry with you is someone that you know, is helps you feel more complete, is supporting you in doing whatever the right thing is to do.
Yeah.
If the person doesn't, you know, then there's an interior conflict with you. And that conflict is roiling around inside of you.
Yeah.
I tell couples, you know, the worst thing you can do is get all pissed off, tell each other to fuck off, and then don't talk to each other for a couple of days, because the person that the other guy is carrying around is your worst self. That's who that they're identifying you as.
Yeah.
Never do that. You know, at least let the person know, you know, I can't talk anymore because I'm going to say something mean, but I love you. I'm a good person who loves you, and you're a good person who's loved by me, and we'll get through this then walk out. It's, you want the last thing you say to be something wise and loving.
Right on. It seems so basic. Kind of we're making a distinction here between a secure couple and an insecure couple.
That's
right.
True.
So there's in a way, just to simplify it here. And if there are listeners out there, they might be identifying with, oh shit, I'm in the insecure camp. What other than like, I mean, they're up against their own physiology and their own history and their own, et cetera, their own nervous sure. system. And what practical things can they do to get more secure? I'm hearing things like respect, speak kindly, you know, watch your tone of voice when you, because when that person's leaving, like you're sending them, I don't know, good vibes or something, you're not actually resenting and being pissed off. And that any of that, if I'm doing that and that activity is going on in me, I need to go work on myself to have that chill out.
Sure.
I need to have the self-awareness that number one, it's going on. Number two, I need to take the responsibility, like you're yep. saying, to then do something about it so that I can have the kind of tone of voice and respect that my partner ultimately deserves and needs to chill out.
Yeah. So what do? Well, one, you develop the tools. You know, you can't really get around the fact you got to develop mindfulness.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but the bottom line is you need to be able to self-observe with acceptance and caring intent.
And you got to want to self-observe, even number one, right?
You got to want to do it. You got to want to grow, and then you practice it. A daily practice of 10 or 15 minutes will do it. But, you know, you need to have the capacity to do it. Ultimately, you want to be able to do it when you're in a state of stress.
Yeah.
Most people can't in a state of stress. They regress. And so at some point, if you practice this, you can observe yourself regressing in a state of stress. If you're doing that, you notice there's somebody observing. That person is a yeah. developmental achievement. That's whoever's observing you regressing is not the person regressing. He's the person observing you regressing, and he's wiser, he's deeper, and he's more mature, and you can trust his judgment more than the person who's regressing.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people a lot, you know, when you're mad, don't trust what you think. Okay.
Yeah.
It's going to be distorted.
Yeah, it's like when you're emotional, that's not the place you want to make big decisions from.
When you're threatened, your brain goes into a defensive state that's characterized by amplified or numbed emotions, distorted perspectives, destructive impulses, and reduced capacities for empathy and self-reflection. That's a defensive state. Your brain enters that automatically in 60 to 80 milliseconds when you're threatened. You discover that defensive state consciously, if at all, at 500 to 1500 milliseconds. And in general, that's how consciousness works. Our shadow, our non-conscious, produces stories and impulses and memories and ideas, and our conscious self gets them after they've been produced.
Yeah.
And does whatever it decides to do. And they're not just produced randomly or valueless. They're produced with values. They're produced out of our current worldview with a moral valence. We observe them as they come up. And as we observe them, we have a moral reaction to what's coming up. These are not in sync developmentally because it's so complicated. Self-awareness, and you look at it, you bring compassionate understanding to bear on that process that feeds it back into your non-conscious, which helps your shadow grow. In that process, the next time it comes up, it's likely to come up a little bit less crazy, a little bit more wise. And this is why meditation accelerates vertical development developmentally. It takes that circuit and it works it with compassionate self-observation.
Wow. Wow, this is brilliant stuff. Do you have any of this written down somewhere if someone wants to dig deeper in this? Because this, like understanding the brain and the milliseconds, that to me, I'm like, I'm hungry for like, I want more of that.
Yes.
Do you have it written down? Where is it written
down? Yeah, sure. Read my book, Integral Mindfulness. Read my book, The Intuned Family, and read my book, The Gift of Shame. I was so...
Do you have the brain science in all of those?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, is there any... If you had to pick one, so not everybody's going to go on Amazon and order all three. Which one...
Integral Mindfulness, my latest one.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, pick that one.
All right, good.
I'm writing a book on shadow right now. You know, I wrote a book on shame because shame was so misunderstood. It just pissed me off.
Yeah.
And so, I wrote a book about, hey, look, shame is necessary to develop, you know, pro-social people.
You're one of the few people that is singing this song, and I'm loving it because this is what I've come to, and it feels like people are shaming shame.
I know.
Right?
You know, when I published that book, I thought, I expected the world to change. You know, I thought like, you know, a year after I published that book, I'd have people from all over the world going, wow, you know, you really redefined how defenses, you know, This is a more accurate depiction of how defenses go, why it's necessary to develop defensive states, and what we can do about them. Of course, you know, that was grandiose. You know,
yeah.
The people who read it have certainly had that reaction. You know,
well, I mean, people's consciousness around shame is pretty stuck. You know, so they're not ready. They're not ready for you, Keith.
You know, that's why I like telling audience: you need to shame your children appropriately. Anyway, yes, and I'm writing a book on shadow right now because I think shadow's misunderstood.
Yeah.
You know, that whole loop of observing shadow with whatever moral valence it has, and then bringing more superior values to bear and feeding that back into your non-conscious to support the development of shadow, of your implicit self, of your adaptive unconscious, that supports your vertical development, that helps you love and be loved better. You know, that's basically developing a relationship with shadow that's neurobiologically based, and that's just necessary for us to go to the levels of development that we can all see but can't stably inhabit.
Yeah, cool. So here's what I want to do now, because we got to transition. I just want to honor your time, and I'm loving this because I'm like, dude, I could go for hours with you. I want to dig into shame a little bit for listeners that want to go deeper, and maybe after the call, can we just take 10 minutes on shame and zero in on men and sexuality and shame?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool. So let's wind up. Where can people find you? Where do you want people to go?
So my most recent book is Integral Mindfulness, From Clueless to Dialed In.
Nice. You know,
we go through the world either clueless, which is making the same mistake over and over again, not noticing, ridiculous,
yeah,
to mindless, which we make the same mistake over again, but somebody points it out to us, we'll change, to mindful, which we have capacities for self-observation, to dialed in, where we're aware of ourselves, and we have an understanding of what's the more healthy and less healthy response in most situations. Great. Integral mindfulness teaches that. So that book.
And where can they find that? On your website, on Amazon, where should they go?
You can get it from my website. You can get an e-version on my website. You can get it from Amazon. And then there's an audio course that's about 5 hours that I did with David Reardon as the producer with Integral Life called Loving Completely. Mm. Now, this course is about relationships.
Yeah.
It's about, one, how do I choose people? Because not a lot of people have ways of doing it, so I have a way of choosing people. There's questions you ask yourself. And how do I evaluate a relationship, and how do I support my development in crucial dimensions? And the dimensions basically are erotic polarity, maintaining your physical, psychological health, being able to get back to love through conflict, showing up as a parent or a family member, and having deep purpose, deep soul's purpose.
Mm.
And so, Beautiful. Okay, Loving Completely.
Where's that course?
That's on Integral Life. Just Google Integral Life and find my course.
Loving Completely, Keith Witt, Dr. Keith Witt.
And then drkeithwitt.com is my website. And I have 5 books published. You can get any of them on my website. I have 21 lectures called the School of Love Lecture Series. You can buy it for 10 or 15 bucks, depending on whether you want a video or an audio. I have a series of mini classes, you know, 5 to 10 minute classes on things that are really important. And I have a page called Integral Conversations, where I talk to a lot of integral people in the world, particularly my friend Jeff Talsman, about applying a multiple perspective approach to a wide variety of topics that have to do with living and loving.
Yeah, wow, beautiful. I mean, if someone wants to go deeper, Keith's one of the guys to go to here. So if you want to go down a rabbit hole, go to his website, drkeithwitt.com, right?
Come to my rabbit hole.
And just get in there, and especially for the integral people out there who kind of can grok that. I also like the way you talk about integral, because to me, it's digestible. Sometimes people can talk integral in a way that is like, what are you talking about? Yeah. So I appreciate that.
You know, integral is irritating to learn, but wonderful once you learn it.
Oh yeah.
So I speak from integral all the time, but I don't talk about integral unless somebody asks me about it.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it works, I think, for me. So, okay. And then parting piece of advice. Let's say someone's wanting to move towards these, maybe a secure relationship, or they just want to have a more fulfilling relationship. Like, what's the kind of, if you had to leave a parting nugget of advice, what would you say to them?
First of all, if you're in a relationship, you have a responsibility to take care of yourself and to maintain your partner and you in love. You have a responsibility to do it. You know, and it's a big deal. You know, I didn't make any promises in my wedding vows. I didn't have any vows. Because you don't do things because you promise to do things. You do things because you resolve to do things, which is very different.
Right on.
Okay, so what I encourage people to do is resolve to love and be loved with your partner every day. If that is not working, talk to them about it.
Yeah.
And make progress. If you do not make progress, find some therapist somewhere and make progress with that therapist. Because human beings influence each other heavily. And receiving influence is one of the most important characteristics in being a human and in developing. And so if it's not working, if you're not making satisfying progress or progress, get somebody to help. Get a therapist, get a coach, get a minister, get somebody to help you grow. Yeah. Do not be satisfied with not progressing.
That's right.
So that's my advice.
Right on. So bottom lining that is take responsibility for your life and for your relationship every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Every moment.
Beautiful.
You know, James Masterson, one of my favorite object relationist guys, the object relationist guys, it's a whole genre of intricate, you know, penis head, super talking crazies. But, you know, they had some good stuff. So he wrote a book on narcissistic borderline personality disorders. It was about all the, you know, craziness. But he had one line about health. He said, a healthy person takes responsibility for everything they experience or do.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff Salzman interviewed a Navy SEAL. He said, what characterizes the Navy SEALs? He said, Navy SEALs all take 100% responsibility for everything they experience and do. No excuses.
Yeah.
And that's what makes a Navy SEAL.
Whew. And a tall order for some of us, depending on where we're at in life, right? So thanks for that parting piece of advice there. I love it, Keith. And I'm so grateful you came on the show, the Smart Couple here. And if you want to dig deeper, go to drkeithwitt.com and the other sites he suggested. And also, if you go to Cock Talk, if you're a man and you want to hear a little bit about this shame conversation, we're going to have a little nugget from Keith in there. Yo, yo, that was a wild ride with Dr. Keith Witt. I think that was a really important conversation because we dug into a lot of terrain. And it's kind of like Keith's mind and his website. I was thinking about where the hell to send you after this episode. And in looking around on his website, I was like, Jesus, this is like Keith's brain. It's just so full of information and goodies. So the place I'm going to send you is drkeithwitt.com. Go there, and he has a tremendous amount of resources on relationship. And this guy seems to me lives it and walks his talk, and he has a very deep, wide view. He's really into the integral map. And if you like that, Keith has a tremendous amount on his website around that. And just a whole bunch of good, I think, simple stuff to digest on relationship. A lot of short videos. He's got a couple books. So great blog posts. So check him out, drkeithwitt.com. Secondarily, we talked after our call for another 15 minutes or so around men and our sexuality and cocks and shame. And we zeroed in on shame a bit. So if you're interested in that conversation, just go to jasongaddis.com/cocktalk and you can opt in there. And eventually you will get the episode where Keith and I break it down a bit and go further and a little deeper around men and shame and sexuality. Okay. So hopefully you enjoyed this, and we will talk very soon.